not hamper nighttime vision. What is it about red light that's different in our eyes and experience?
Blood don't see red. And that's part of it. Your real dark adaptation is the false sensitivity of the rods when they haven't seen the light that they see, if you know what I mean. So red is good at that. However, the latest issue of Astronomy Magazine has an article on just that subject, is the red filters that we're using. I mean, when you're at a star party, when a whole bunch of guys have got a bunch of telescopes set up on a great big field in the dark, and people walking around don't want to run into other people's telescopes, so they walk around with a red flashlight, a dim red flashlight. And so the article is now going into the subject, is red the best subject? And what shade of red and what brightness of red should that flashlight be so that you're not hurting other people's eyes, dark adaptation, and yet you're seeing enough of the map you want to look at, of the sky chart you've got, or you're about to walk around and you don't want to run into other people's equipment. So red is classically used. It may not be the best color, but I think the main reason is that the rods are nowhere near as sensitive to red. So you're using enough red light to excite your cones of your eyes, you get the high resolution capability without hurting people's dark adaptation. I think that's the attempt that's going on there, Roy. Bernie, K2IO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very interesting. I'm just dovetailing this into what Eric said earlier about that it's difficult, in early CRTs, it's difficult to produce red. So I'm wondering if red is, I was just curious that the elements, the technical elements they were using trying to produce it in our bodies have a similar response. Anyway, that's just thank you for the answer, K2IO.
This is KB2MAL with an unrelated question for Bernie for Hamvention.
Yeah, as long as you're here, Bernie, Gabe, KB2MAR, has got some questions for you. One of those questions is going to be what's the recommended frequencies for the handy talkies for people of Limehouse that want to talk to each other while they're at Dayton. I'll turn it over to Gabe. KB2MAR, K2LIW, go ahead, Gabe.
Thanks, Dick. Sorry to interrupt you guys. I was just curious, Bernie, if you knew a frequency that was used by Limehouse members at, for past conventions, that's a frequency that we could all congregate on.
First off, that implies you're going, so that's great. I'd love to see you there. There is a frequency. It's, I don't know. It's Lens Repeater, if that helps any. It's the big tower you can see from the flea market, but all of that is not exactly what you can program into your radio. If you send me an email, my email is bernie@huntfamily.com in the roster also. I will put that out. I will also put it out on the club email list. So everybody has it. It's one we've used before. It's the UHF frequency. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly.
By the way, if you guys have any pencil and paper handy, I have some frequencies to hand to you over the air if you were patient.
Okay, give us those frequencies, Gabe.
Can you use the new for a second? Okay, these are the repeater frequencies for digging the invention here. We have a talking frequency, that's 136.940. That's a negative offset, of course. The tone is 123. That's the invention talking. The other one for talking, the backup, at 136.910. Of course, it's a negative. Talking backup frequency. Then there's a 146.640 negative offset, a tone of 123. That's a Sky One weather. There's a 145.110 negative, and the tone is a 67. That's airy. 146.820 negative, tone of 77. That's a good 118 area repeater. Another one is 147.360 positive, and the tone is 77. Now the 440, a 442.100 positive, a tone of 123. 442.295 positive, tone of 123. And the 442.950 positive, tone of 118.8. Over to you, Rich.
Gabe, give me that very last one again, that UHF frequency.
Okay, that's 442.950. That is a positive tone, and it's 118.8 PL.
Okay. And so, but Bernie has his own favorite frequency, and he's going to be telling us that, so you guys can talk directly to each other per se. And I'm recommending that you use a handy talkie of medium quality. You might have some grief with the Baofengs because they've got an extremely wide open front end. And when you're at that Dayton Hamvention and you're standing there with 20,000 other hams and you're all in the fraction of a square mile and you're all blasting away with your handy talkies to each other, that Baofeng in your hand is going to be so overloaded, it's going to be giving you all kinds of responses that are not real. That's a guess on my part as to what might happen. And so a higher intercept point, slightly higher quality of handy talky might be in order to make grief a little bit less. Let's see if Bernie's got some opinions on this one. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, I'll upgrade your answer of a Baofeng will have problems. It is not may, it will. Also, Jesus Kenwoods, all of those will have problems also. Any radio that offers a, shall we say, a scanning function or a, you know, DC to daylight receive kind of function, they will have a problem. Oddly enough, last year, I was standing next to Kevin. He had a, I believe a Kenwood or something, it doesn't matter what, but a typical HC. I had a Conexus DMR radio. He got all kinds of intermod. I got none. I won't say none. I had extremely small amounts. And as I thought about it more, I realized that DMR radios don't have a broadband receive function. They are UHF only. And so if you've got a DMR radio, put the analog frequencies in it. And that's, at least last year, that's what I found worked best.
These are special event frequencies. There's a 40 meter one at 7.050, that is also 7.227. 20 meter is 14.050 / 14.270. And a 10 meter of 28.050 / 28.470. And they're going to be, during the times, they're going to be between 9 a.m. and 6 a.m. Friday. Saturday, I'm sorry, 9 a.m. and 6 a.m. as Friday and Saturday, and then 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. Sunday.
Gabe, is this particular information on a particular website, like the Hamvention website? Is that where you're getting this from, Gabe? Go ahead.
An old Hamvention program. I got it from there. And the reason why I wanted to ask Bernie, because I know that you don't want to hog up the repeaters too much because there's a lot of activity going on. I was wondering if the Limark members had a certain simplex frequency where you can communicate in the general area. And of course, occasionally we could probably go on a repeater. But, you know, whenever Bernie has that frequency, maybe we can meet on the air during the evening rush hour, so to speak.
I think that's what Bernie was promising. He's going to send out on one of the channels. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LAW, go ahead, Bernie.
Thank you.
you've got a third one. KC2WGB. K2RIW in the tech van.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we finished that one, and I have one more if we have time. You think we do?
On the way.
Okay, this should rather be a quick one. This young ham is asking why we have tapered potentiometers. He'd like to know why linear taper, why they needed aggressive increments on the pots, and for what use, what were they trying to accomplish? Maybe give him a little background on that, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
A human hearing is logarithmic. By that I mean, every time you double what the human brain says, yeah, that's a little bit louder, it's approximately 1 or 2 dB louder, and that works all the way up the scale. So therefore, if you've got the right kind of a logarithmic taper to the potentiometer, then you will get what feels like equal loudness increments for each number of degrees you turn that potentiometer. So it's accommodating the non-linearity of human hearing. If, for instance, the potentiometer was thoroughly linear, then that last few degrees when you're turning down the sound, when you go from 0.1 volts to 0.0 volts, so to speak, at the bottom of the potentiometer, that's a huge number of decibels of change in a very small turning of the potentiometer. So you'd like it to taper off much more slowly in that direction. So it is my guess that the taper of the potentiometers is to accommodate this crazy characteristic of a human being. The lightness sensitivity of your eye is primarily logarithmic. The sound tense sensitivity of your ear is primarily logarithmic. At first you say, why in the world did Mother Nature make that nonlinear? I'll give you an example. If I take an oscilloscope screen, which is thoroughly linear, from the bottom of the screen to the top of the screen, the top of the screen is the strongest signal you can tolerate without going over the top and distorting it, and the bottom of the screen is the smallest signal your eye can easily see. With rough approximation, the dynamic range on that screen is 30 decibels. 1,000 to 1 power ratio is what you can see on that screen. If I'm using a spectrum analyzer, which is using a log IF amplifier, where each vertical box is 10 decibels, and I get 10 vertical boxes, I can easily display close to 100 dB on that screen, because it is a logarithmic display, whereas the linear display can barely give you 30 dB. So you can get a lot more dynamic range on the screen and a lot easier interpretation. Whenever you're using, let me drop. Whenever you're using certain brands of spectrum analyzers where you can flip one of the knobs on the front panel or call up one of the menus so that the display is no longer logarithmic, it's now linear, you'll suddenly notice that the tops of the signals, the strong signals, get overemphasized, and the weak signals all dive into the noise, and you can't see them. So it's like, well, if you get used to a logarithmic display on a spectrum analyzer, and you flip over to linear, you'll be very unhappy. And that's sort of what would happen if you had a logarithmic taper potentiometer, and somebody replaced it with a linear. You wouldn't like the way it behaves. That's what I think is going on. I'm going to turn it back to you, John. Drag your feet in case other people want to correct me on this, because I haven't read the information I just told you. It is my guesses and assumptions. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. You know, I know Eric does a lot of recording work, and he has worked with a lot of mixers. He may have some more information if he's still around. Let's try and see what Eric has to say. KC2WGB.
You've got it, Eric. to your next question, John.
Oh, that was it, Dick. That was the last of the questions. I just thought Eric might want to make a comment, but obviously he's busy. No problem. Let's go on to Paul and see what's happening out in space. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that guy Elon Musk is in the news quite a bit lately, Paul. And also NASA is in the news this last week because they just released another great big list of exoplanets. That means planets going around some other star and some other place outside of our solar system. And so now there's a total of 3,002, as I remember, total planets that we know of. And at least 21 of them are in the Goldilocks zone, implying that by our standards, they're capable of supporting life. And some good percentage of those, I'm guessing, really has life. WS2F with space report number 201, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
This is WS Flynn. Good evening, Dick, John, everybody else. The Kepler, yeah, I read that, I think, a day or two ago. And they're up to, like you said, over 3,000 confirmed planets. Kepler, I think, has done, like, the lion's share of it, like, 2,300 of them. And more to come, but, you know, they just released more information. I'm still trying to figure out if any of these new ones were from the K2 mission, you know, after Kepler had the problems with the momentum wheels that they didn't define in the article I read. So we'll have to see. But I'm waiting for the test of the next telescope to be launched that's going to do this type of work. Yeah, when that thing goes up, that's going to find a lot more Earth-like type of planets, you know, because of the orbit it's going to be in and all of that. That's the transiting exoplanet satellite, I guess survey satellite probably. But the acronym comes out as TESS. I know we talked about it probably a couple of years ago when it was being worked on. But now that's planned to go up next year. That's going to actually join the Kepler or K2 in looking for planets. And that'll probably come out, I guess, with thousands of more planets that thing will find. Let me drop it. One thing I wanted to bring up is, you know, before I go on, we forget. On something that Limark is doing. They have at the Cradle of Aviation this Friday. They're going to have a special event station set up there. So and I know that comes out in all the emails and everything, but I thought I'd mention again that it's between 9 a.m. and 4:30 at the Cradle of Aviation. And they take out the atrium. They use that. So we'll be there. I won't be, but Limark will be. And they set up a bunch of HF radios. Not sure exactly what bands they're going to work or anything, but they've done them, you know, a couple of times. It's pretty good. The 20th is Charles Lindbergh. You know, when he flew out of Roosevelt Field. So they celebrate that 1927 event. So I had to mention that. You know, the other thing that's always in the news, like you said, Elon Musk, he brought back a dragon just the middle of the week. I think it was Wednesday, from the International Space Station, successfully landed in the Pacific Ocean. That's the same one. That's the same one that went up a little over a month ago and bought the beam, the Bigelow expandable activity module up to the International Space Station, which isn't inflated yet. They plan on doing that the end of the month, or maybe the beginning of June. But I mean, that's the module that was taken out of the trunk of Dragon and after it was docked to the International Space Station, and they located it onto the aft port of the Tranquility module. And it's sitting there, getting ready to be inflated. But meanwhile, the Dragon had brought up, you know, maybe over 3,000 pounds more of supplies that had to be unloaded over the last 4 weeks, all by the Americans and the European Space Agency. The Russians didn't have to do much. I don't think much of the equipment was for them. And same for packing. They loaded up probably 3,000 pounds of equipment, including two big freezers filled with science experiments, including the one-year mission from Scott Kelly when he was up there. All the blood samples and all the tissue samples and all the stuff that they got off of him has been sitting in these freezers for a year. So Dragon being really the only spaceship right now capable of bringing stuff back, you know, large quantities of stuff, thousands of pounds, in this case a little over 3,000 pounds of science equipment, including a spacesuit they brought back, full-size spacesuit that Tim from the European Space Agency, when he was Tim Peake was out there, and he had problems with the water leaking, and now they're gonna look at that spacesuit when NASA gets it back. So that thing landed, like I said, on Wednesday in the Pacific Ocean, and SpaceX has its own boat crane, and they loaded it onto the boat. I guess probably back in San Diego Harbor now. That's their harbor. And so they really bring things back. They bring back they brought back the Dragon cargo vehicle, and they also brought back on that same flight the first almost 150-foot, 12-foot diameter first stage of the Falcon 9 rocket. Successfully landed that on the barge, the ASDS, autonomous spaceship, drone ship, successfully, and they plan on doing that again in a couple of weeks when they do another similar flight, putting another spacecraft into geosynchronous orbit. Let me drop it. And they're not the only ones that are getting ready. In July, there should be a new Antares launch. Antares is a new rocket that's built by Orbital Science. And Orbital Science is a company, now it's called Orbital ATK. ATK got involved with Orbital probably about a year and a half ago, and now they plan on launching their new newly built rocket. The Antares has gone up before, but with different engines. Antares had the old Russian engines, which worked out for the first couple of flights, but then in October of 2014, one of the engines let loose, blew up as it was taking off, and destroyed the spacecraft, the rocket, and quite a bit of infrastructure at the launch pad at Wallops Island in Virginia. So that's all been rebuilt, and they're getting ready to go again with brand new engines. Not the same engines. They're Russian engines, but they're actually called RG-191s. Engines that have been
it's a variant of one of the successful engines that have flown many, many times. And they'll be bringing up the Cygnus spacecraft to the International Space Station. And Cygnus, the enhanced version, similar to, actually the same type that went up on the Atlas V rocket. Atlas launched two Cygnus cargo spacecraft.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
In the last couple of months, they did the last two flights was by them, and they were very successful, and they enhanced Cygnus spacecraft. Is much larger, carries more weight, more volume, and because they have new engines, more powerful engines on the new Antares rocket, that will be utilized this time around, and they won't need the Atlas rockets anymore unless something happens. The reason they use the Atlas rockets, they needed to fulfill their contract with NASA. It's a billion-dollar contract. Let me drop this WS2N. I'm not going to go through everything I have here because it's like way too many things. And every week, I think things are going to be slowing down, but it's going the other way. It's accelerating. Like we thought the expansion of the universe was slowing down, we found out it was accelerating. That's the way it's gone with the space program lately. Now the Russians have started working on their new spacecraft. You know, they've been launching the Soyuz spacecraft with different versions for decades now. You know, literally probably, you know, thousands of launches of the Soyuz rocket, along with the Soyuz spacecraft for all the man launches, and similarly looking Progress rocket that they launch on that same rocket. They've been developing over the years new manned spacecraft, much bigger, and they always had some strange name to it. Now they've actually given it a real name, called the Federation. Federation is going to be similar size to the Orion spacecraft, the American Orion spacecraft that NASA's been putting together for quite a few years now. It's going to be similar in size. It's going to have the capability of sending a half a dozen astronauts up to the International Space Station if they want. Let me drop it. Russian Federation is spaceship will also be capable of going to the moon. They have visions of actually going back to the moon. They're not as hopped up going to Mars like NASA is, or Elon Musk with SpaceX. They would like to go back to the moon and have their own space station someday in the future when the ISS eventually has to be abandoned. It does have a future right now, probably to at least 2024, most likely to 2028, but after that, who knows? So they'll have this new Federation spacecraft, and it's interesting. Looks like it's got even more capabilities than Orion. Orion you can only use once. This thing's going to be reusable. It's also going to be able to re-enter the atmosphere. Similar to what Elon Musk does, or will be doing with the crew versions of the Dragon spacecraft. By propulsion, without using any parachutes whatsoever. So the Russians got this similar type of idea that Elon Musk wants, you know, has to have this thing flying out of orbit and land back at their launch facility in Russia.
topics, but I think that's plenty for now, Dick. We could always pick them up next week or sometime after that. They're the main topics, K2RIW, WS2X.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Go right ahead, Glenn. Wait for the four beeps.
It's kind of interesting, this question, I'm not sure if maybe I'm going to direct it towards you, Paul. You had mentioned something that, something I've noticed on a few websites lately that have been coming up over the last few months where they're pointing out that since like 2011, there's been a lot of different areas all around the Earth where they're basically saying that a lot of space junk is coming in from a lot of stuff from China, U.S., European Union, and it seems to have really picked up steam. And you can see the serial numbers on the stuff coming in. And I think you might have alluded to it that, you know, it seems like everybody's launching a lot more stuff up there. But has there been any reports other than just like these personal accounts where people are putting all the stuff up on YouTube of all the space junk that's actually coming back down and landing in some pretty precarious places? I'm not sure who to throw it back to, but Dick, I'll hand it back to you for the net. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's a question for you, Paul. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, space junk has always been a problem, and it's just getting worse. Most of the launches now by European Space Agency, they launched the Vega rocket. They have a Soyuz rocket and an Ariane 5 rocket. They've managed to get their first stages, not back safely, but they come out of orbit and they burn them up if they go into orbit, or if they go on a suborbital flight, you know, the first stage, and make sure it comes back down into a unoccupied ocean somewhere. SpaceX is doing the same thing. They might not necessarily be able to get their first stage back. So if they miss, it'll hit the ocean. They've done that many times. One of their flights, first stage wound up in orbit, and it deorbited over Brazil, and it really lit up the sky, they said, and there was some parts found in the field. So, I mean, this goes back decades. I remember there was a Cosmos, a Russian satellite that landed in Canada that had a radioactive plutonium on board, and that caused a big concern. Drop it. But a lot, you know, there are a lot of these parts that they survive. They make it all the way down, and they do hit land every now and then. So in the future, they plan on eventually, hopefully, getting together, you know, some of the countries and chipping in to develop these satellites. I think I mentioned last week or the week before. I know Japan has got one that they're developing, but you know, they don't want to pay for the whole thing themselves, so they'll have to put some more pressure on other countries. There's thousands and thousands of pieces of things flying around. Not to mention some of the ones that have actually collided. There's been a couple of them. Just recently, Japan launched a space telescope that was supposed to be looking at the X-ray spectrum. So it was quite heavy. But I think it was about a month or two ago. They launched it, and it lost control of it and started spinning. And what happened is it just ripped itself apart. So now you've got this heavy telescope with, you know, maybe 10 pieces floating around in orbit. And hopefully it'll eventually deorbit, but that one was pretty high up. So, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. You ever see the pictures of this stuff flying around the Earth, you know, that NORAD puts out? It looks like a car. cloud, you know. It's got to be addressed. You're right, Glenn. Back to you, Dick.
Go ahead, Dick. Glenn, hit Eric.
Paul, I have a question for you. Although I think I know the answer, but I want to hear it from you. What do we do with dead geosynchronous satellites? Which way do they go?
Well, the ones that break, unfortunately, they can't do anything with them. But I think you mean the ones when they know that the end of service is near. The average satellite is 15 years. That's standard procedure. And they'll push it into a higher orbit, or what they call a graveyard orbit. So, you know, instead of 23,000 miles out, they'll push it out another couple of thousand miles. And when it's out there, since the air is, I mean, there is no air in low Earth orbit, you have some rarefied air to slow things down, but out there, it'll stay out there for maybe thousands of years. They'll never come back. So that's what they do with them. But the ones that, there's been a couple that have broke out there, and the batteries have blown up, and that could cause a problem. And they do worry about stuff like that. Now there's plans of sending a satellite up to dock with these satellites and to do either one of two things, either attach to it and refuel it, which sounds very difficult to me. Drop it. To either keep the satellites alive for a longer period than 15 years, or to, you know, boost it into a higher orbit. I like the other plan that they have. They want to launch a satellite, attach it to an existing satellite, and then push it out. Have that, you know, the one that attached to it have a thruster on it and push it out to a different orbit. That's the plan of SES. They're the biggest operators of satellites in the world, and they come out of Luxembourg. And their next satellite and all the satellites that they have planned right now are going to have that docking capability, where in the future they could have other satellites dock with it and push it out to a different orbit using fuel on board. But that's pretty much what I know about it. Back to you, or I guess back to that. Back to you, Dick.
Thanks, Paul. That's pretty much confirmed what I've been told and what I've heard. And actually, it was a few years back we lost the CBS satellite, and they actually lost command and control of it. Eventually, they were able to fire it, what's remaining of the rocket, and push it out. And I've heard of a story or two where they had miscalculated. There was much more fuel available on one of the satellites that they were going to retire, and it went way past the graveyard. From what I gather, it's still inching its way away from us, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. And by the way, the service life of most of our communication satellites is 10 years. So. Thanks a lot. Back to you, Dick, P2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I can think of three reasons, Eric, as to why at the end of life, in theory, you've carefully calculated how much reaction fuel you've got left. And when you got the last few percent left, and the satellite is now at the end of life, you blast it into a higher orbit. I can think of three reasons for doing that. Number one, at first you would think, hey, let's bring it all the way back down. Bring it into the atmosphere and get rid of it. Well, the amount of thrusting required to do that is almost identical to the amount of thrusting it took to get it there in the first place. You know how big that rocket was on the ground to get it where it is. It would take something approximately that size to get it all the way back down. Nowhere near as easy as you think. Second of all, any lower orbit, if you didn't have enough fuel to go all the way back down, means that it's now in the way of anything that's about to come back up. So it's a hazard. Let me drop it. A third reason you put it up into a graveyard orbit that's higher is because of gravity hydrodynamics. Every satellite that is in lower than synchronous orbit is slowly spiraling inward to a lower orbit because of the gravity hydrodynamics between the satellite and the Earth. At real low orbits, you're getting Earth drag, atmospheric drag. But even if you're above the atmosphere, there's still a slow tendency for the wave action of the Earth, the tides and whatever, to do a little bit of either pushing or pulling on the satellite. And so it pulls on the satellite if you're lower than synchronous orbit, slowly making it spiral inward. If the satellite is at a higher orbit than synchronous orbit, the pushing of the wave motion of the tides is going to slowly push it outward to a higher orbit. So you put something in the graveyard, in theory it never comes back, you never have a problem with it. So I think you see those three reasons, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
Thank you for that explanation. It just reconfirmed what I always thought, and was my opportunity to find out if it was correct. It does lead to problems still, because think about all the stuff that we put out there. By the way, most communication satellites are huge and heavy and bigger than a lot of the stuff that they put up there. So I don't think that much of it will burn up in the atmosphere, but there's going to be something left. But that problem when we start doing a little trip to the moon, or even when we launch something off these days, we've got to track of where everything is. That's what the what do they call it? Sat command in the mountains, or what used to be known as NORAD. They keep track of every little bit of junk. KQRW, KQRW.
QIQ with another question.
Go ahead.
You know, it was just one of the other things Paul was mentioning about the Russians concentrating more on the moon than going over to Mars. And I was reading a couple articles where apparently they were saying something about Russia's attempt at sending, I guess, satellites and probes out to Mars have been largely unsuccessful. Probably to the point that something like, they can make it out to there, but in orbit either they lose control or whatever it is, and apparently their success rate's been like, or failure rate, for that matter, has been something close to like 90%. I was wondering if there was anything further about that. That might be one of the reasons that they're planning on concentrating more on the moon. And or the other question, too, is kind of like, what's our success rate for the amount of probes that we've sent to Mars in terms of their failure to success rate? Back to you, Dick, first. K2RZ, K2QIQ.
And to exchange it with Mark.
Hey, you got that, Paul.
I know the Russians had quite a few problems. Their last attempt was Bobo's Grunt, I think they call it. That was a mission to Mars, and it never got out of Earth's atmosphere. They just had bad luck, and they were running the Proton rocket, and the Proton rocket has had quite a few problems. I think it was 20% failure rate. And they think that they've got it ironed out now for future flights. Some of the important flights, with the Proton rocket, they launched the first two big pieces to the International Space Station with the Proton rocket, and it was successful. They launched Zarya, and they launched Zesta. Zarya was the functioning cargo block, which was essentially the machine room of the International Space Station. It was first being built, and Zesta, after that, the main lab and living quarters for the Russians. But the Proton on it out of the failures, and one of them was this Mars launch, and that went south. Other ones that they tried, all sorts of Mars failed. The Mars lander that they sent up failed. It landed, and they got 20 seconds. 20 seconds of transmission, and it failed. It was called Mars 3, and that was the name of it. And that didn't work out. And they've had some other problems. Their interest in the beginning was really Venus. They were interested in Venus. They sent quite a few landers to Venus and were successful. I think they've always been interested in the moon, with the competition of sending man there, and they've never done it, of course, and they would like to do that, and they're working on a lot of different possibilities on how they're going to do that. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Chinese and Russia fighting over who's going to land on the moon next, but if China keeps going the way they're going, they might do it. American successes, we've done great lately. I mean, just one right after the other. There were a couple in the 90s. They were trying to do a cheaper, faster, better system with a lot of their rockets. So we had problems with, we had the Mars climate orbiter, which failed. Let me drop it. That got all the way out there and failed, and during that same launch window, which is roughly every 27 months, we also set the Mars Polar Lander, and that one also failed. But Mars Polar Lander, they resurrected that, they rebuilt that, and added more fancy stuff to it, and eventually renamed it and called it the Phoenix, and that was very successful. That landed on the northern hemisphere of Mars and collected a lot of good information and showed that there was ice one morning, and then the next morning it disappeared, so they know it evaporated. That was called the Phoenix. And of course, many of our missions, the two early missions, the Viking missions, were successful back in 1976. And they also had orbiter missions attached to it, and they would orbit Mars and relay information back. So they were both very successful. But then after the Viking missions, we waited a long time, and it wasn't really until Pathfinder went up there and landed and let out it opened up and let out Sojourner, that little small microwave-sized rover driving around on Mars. That was the next big success for us. Let me drop it. There was one other one, the Mars Observer, I believe it was called, that we sent. And that was supposed to go into orbit, and it just kept going right past Mars. And they never even heard from it again. They knew it was getting close, and it just kept going. But then we had one success after the other with the satellites that went into orbit. We had the Mars Global Surveyor, which operated for like 15 years. That finally quit. And then we had Mars Odyssey still operating, again in orbit, acting as a repeater for the rovers on the surface of Mars. And then we had the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's still up there also for many, many years. I think that passed its 10-year anniversary, and they expect it to go on and on. There is plans on eventually sending more, because they feel these satellites that are going around Mars are eventually going to fail. And when they have future manned missions, they're going to need some kind of communications to relay back to Earth. But right now, they're still doing good. And then we, of course, sent the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, which Opportunity is still working since 2004. We dropped it.
trying to do the math in my head, but it's not going to work on a percentage of success. But we've been very successful because we just launched a Curiosity. We were going to launch Insight, but was it Insight? Insight in that that one didn't go. That's going to be delayed a couple of years. So we've had our successes. European Space Agency has had success with orbital missions. European ESA has European. It's the Mars Express presently in orbit around Mars, doing very well. But then we have their first landing attempt with a rover type of thing failed. That was called Beagle 2. So European Space Agency is, I think they're batting 500. Although they do have actually two spacecraft and one on the way to Mars as we speak. One's going to land in on Mars, and that's called the Schiaparelli lander. And they have another one called Trace. Trace is going to study the atmosphere around Mars, and that's going to go into orbit. So maybe they'll be successful with that. We'll see. Even India is on board. They have a spacecraft going around Mars. They're batting 1,000 because their first shot out, it worked. So they're doing good. And they got another one coming, I think 2 years from now, that they're going to Mars as well. Japan has tried it. They failed. China tried it. They failed. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
It's really easy to say, gee, we've gone to the moon, now let's go to Mars. Moon is a
repeater. Time out.
The moon is 250,000 miles, and at maximum range, Mars is something like 300 million miles. So there's something like a 1,000-to-1 ratio of difference in distances, maximum of each. So you could say going to Mars is 1,000 times more difficult, 1,000 times more expensive, 1,000 times, it's not 1,000 times more thrust, but still there's a lot of difficulty there. So, and what do you get in return for that great big investment? Now, all these missions that are talking about colonizing the moon, Cole, do any of them go into the details as to how you begin that colonization? Let me drop. Yeah, we put up 6 groups of men, a total of 12 human beings, 2 at a time, on the surface of the moon. But we did it at a very careful timing and location, where you put them on the moon at a place which is either early in the morning or late in the afternoon. You don't want them there at high noon. And high noon lasts for 12 days, and you don't want them there at midnight. You'll freeze the daylights out of them in one case and boil them like an oven in the other. So that first few steps of putting a colony on the moon that's going to be there for more than a day or two, you could probably stretch it to 3 days. But anything more than 3 days on the moon, you're either going to see some extremely cold or extremely hot temperatures. I don't think there's enough air conditioning in the world that you can easily put on the moon to protect you from those high temperatures. So, do any of these planned moon colonizing missions go into any of those details as to how you put your first foothold onto the moon? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, it's going to start small. You know, China, I think they're going to do it first, where they're going. And it'll be, you know, land, set up some kind of a temporary living quarter for a couple of days. Probably not much different than what we did last off and get them back. It's got to start off that way. And even India would like to do it. India has a planned manned space program. I predict with in about 4 or 5 years, they might have the capability of doing an orbital mission with people from India. They've already sent up a simulated capsule of, you know, a real test article, and tested their heat shield and came back through the atmosphere. But it's a long way off. European Space Agency, yeah, they're concentrating on it, but they have no way to launch people into space. They'll need to, you know, sub it out, you know, to get either Russia or SpaceX or somebody to sign off on launching their people up there. They had plans on, European Space Agency had plans on developing the ATV, the automated transfer vehicle that they used to use for resupplying the International Space Station. It was completely autonomous. It was a real spaceship. It would fly around sometimes a couple of weeks, 3 weeks at a time before it would even dock doing scientific work. But it didn't have the capability of putting people in there. I mean, in reality, there were people in there because it was docked to the space station.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They had plans, let me drop it, of developing that piece of equipment. I saw diagrams of it and it could be used in the docking system for people to go in and living in there, similar to what looked like a small version of Skylab, you know. But they had plans on launching this thing with people in it from French Guiana using the Ariane 5 rocket. You know, it became cost prohibitive, and they kind of dropped that idea. But I wouldn't be surprised if they try to, bring it up later. There's so many countries involved with the European Space Agency that I think they have money problems. They're always, very hard up for money. So they can't make quick decisions. Like, not like one or two countries making a decision, okay, we're going to do it. There's always somebody reneging. So, I don't see this happening for a long time. Let me drop it. Mars is a different story. NASA has definite plans, and they're already put many billions of dollars into the space launch system, which, with Orion on top and eventually a habitat module and a landing module and, return spacecraft in orbit around Mars to get people back. That's, I think, feasible. You're looking at probably 2035. But there's going to be a series of probably 20, 30, 40 launches of these SLS, the Space Launch System, to set up the infrastructure and everything needed to eventually do this. The guy that's got the better shot would be Elon Musk. You know, after the Falcon 9, and I wouldn't be surprised if he releases some more information about what he plans on doing. As it is, he plans on sending a Falcon 9 Heavy up with a Crew Dragon vehicle all the way to Mars in 2018. That's just the start. But then he's got this Mars Colonial Transport idea. Let me drop it. Picture a rocket way bigger than the Falcon 9. In fact, way bigger than the Saturn V. They estimate 60% bigger. This 500-foot monster with a diameter of at least 50 feet,